Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, August 27, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, our telephone will discuss the new book by Professor Todd Zawicki, Consumer Credit and the American Economy. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome to our call today two experts, including the author of the book, the title again, Consumer Credit in the American Economy. We're going to proceed a little bit differently than we sometimes do here on Teleform. We're going to proceed in an interview format. We have Bill Himpler, who's going to, he is the Executive Vice President of American Financial Services Association. He's going to conduct essentially an interview of Professor Zawicki. And then after that, we will be taking questions from the audience, so please do be ready with your questions. Professor Todd J. Zawicki, of course, is author of Consumer Credit and the American Economy and the Foundation Professor of Law at the George Mason University School of Law. And with that, Mr. Himpler, please go right ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Dean. And Todd, it's great to be with you today. I think we probably ought to start off by at least acknowledging your co-authors,
exactly.
Mike Staton, Gregory Ellihausen, and Tom Durkin. Who, just in case they're listening, for anybody who has seen the book, it's over 600 pages, and as smart as Todd is, that's still a Herculean effort, even for four experts, wouldn't you say, Todd?
That's right, and thanks for doing that, Bill. All three of my co-authors are economists. I'm the lone law professor in the group, and it's been a multi-year project, but it finally came out a week or two ago, and needless to say, we're excited about it.
Well, let's jump right in. It's a great treatise that gets really to the heart of a lot of the consumer credit issues facing our country. I guess the first basic threshold question is, why do people borrow, Todd?
Yeah, and that's really understanding consumer credit and consumer credit regulation starts off with understanding that question. Why do people borrow? And there's really kind of two different theories. One is, in many ways, the prevailing theory today, which is the belief by a lot of people that that people borrow because they don't know any better, that they are goaded by a consumerist society and hard sell by banks and that sort of thing, and the taking on more debt that they than they want. They use debt to live beyond their means and then eventually end up in trouble. Now, of course, that's not a new theory. For instance, the theory of conspicuous consumption, which you may have heard of, which said the same thing, was first coined in 1899. We've seen through history a recurrent idea that people borrow too much, or more specifically, that other people borrow too much. We instead look at another strand of history, which is sort of the real economics of consumer credit rather than the conventional wisdom. And economists have a model of consumer credit that goes way back. And basically, why do people borrow? And the answer is for the same reason businesses borrow, which is we borrow for two reasons. First is for capital goods, and second is to smooth income and expenses. So what do we mean by capital goods? It's basically the idea that a business, if they need to dig a ditch, they could hire 10 guys with shovels or buy a backhoe. And the backhoe costs more on the front end, but they can finance it, and out of the increased productivity, increase their wealth, their profitability, by having one guy with a backhoe rather than 10 guys with shovels. And it turns out that's exactly how households traditionally have used consumer credit, which is you can think of the overwhelming number of things that we do with consumer credit as having the same basic logic. Take something as simple as a washing machine. What's the value of a washing machine? It's not having to schlep to the laundromat every Saturday night with a pocket full of quarters. Sure, it costs more on the front end, but essentially what it is a capital investment that provides a flow of benefits to a household, and over time basically increases the wealth of the household by doing that. Think of a car as an example. Investing in student loans is an example to improve your human capital. We don't talk about mortgages in the book, but obviously a home has the same sort of capital investment quality to it. And if you start off with that assumption that consumers use credit for the same reason businesses use credit, you have a very different view of the world and a very different perspective on why it's so important that consumers have access to credit.
Yeah, as you were talking, Todd, I was reminiscing. It is August and kids are back to school, and maybe I'm showing my age, but I remember my mother traipsing my brothers and I down to the local shoe store, and a guy that we knew as Uncle Albert would go in the file cabinet, pull out my mom's account, put our shoes, and there were plenty of shoes because we went through them like water, on the account, and she'd pay it back later. And that was just one place. You know, there was an account at Sears and maybe an account at the grocery store. But you know, we've moved away from that, where those instances of having credit with individual stores very much a private matter between the customer and the retailer, and now it's all kind of conglomerated on credit cards, and it seems like by comparison, if you aggregate all those, yeah, it looks like an explosion.
Yeah, and that's sort of the second point that I think is useful about our book, that again is contradicts the conventional wisdom, but is actually well founded in the data, and we present the data in the book, which is you described the history perfectly, Bill, which is that people have used consumer credit for a very long time. I mean, you can go back to the 20s, back before the Great Depression, and what you see is people used credit for sporting goods, pianos, radios, appliances, the first Sears and Roebuck, and the Sears and Roebuck catalog, beginning in the late 19th century. Basically, you know, the Sears credit card was the vehicle by which people were able to buy all those things in the Sears catalog, up to and including houses. And the decline during the Great Depression, but really, we see this massive expansion of consumer credit right after World War II. As I've said before, consumer credit is the Conestoga wagon of the conquest of Levittown, which is as people moved from the cities out to the suburbs and got that three-bedroom house with a car and a car loan and new appliances and new furniture. We see a great growth of consumer credit that fuels the rise of the American middle class in the mid-20th century. And as we show in the book, and it's very surprising to people, as we show in the book, the growth of credit cards beginning in the 1980s and in the 1990s, all it did was replace all those other forms of credit that you described, Bill. The installment lender at the local shoe store or local personal finance company or wherever you might get it. Now all that just goes on credit cards, and a lot of those alternatives have gone away. And one thing that people don't appreciate is it's not just that credit cards have replaced all that, but the whole economy has benefited from that innovation and dynamism and competition, which is, it used to be, for instance, that department stores, big department stores, had a competitive advantage in the marketplace because they could offer credit and deal with the risk and overhead of it. And now the widespread adoption of credit cards allows online providers of goods and services to compete with Sears or Target or whoever, and that's an extraordinary development in American history.
I'm going to take a little divergent tack, and maybe you started by talking about using credit to be able to afford capital goods like a washer and dryer, car, things like that. Some of the critics of the financial services industry might point to the fact that we've now gone beyond just buying more long-lasting goods, and folks are using credit and credit cards to buy services like buying a burger at McDonald's and putting that on credit. And in that instance, is that a divergence from the past that really overextends folks?
Not that we can see. Again, we can see it in the data. And I talked about one reason people use credit is for capital goods. But it's also been the case that people use credit to, like businesses do, to essentially smooth income and expenses, right? The unexpected doctor bill, the kid who all of a sudden needs a trumpet for band, whatever the case may be, and you just haven't saved up for it. If you look at the data, though, what you see is that in many ways, people don't so much use credit to finance a lot of that consumption that you described, but they do use payment cards, and often the two get lumped together. And in the net, that's a very small percentage of the overall debt that people are carrying, or the things that are putting people in debt compared to these other things. And in fact, what's really quite remarkable is that if you want to talk about unsustainable debt, the real problem, if anywhere, is in student loans, which is over the last 20 years, we have seen this extraordinary growth in student loan debt, such that student loans are now after cars, the second largest non-mortgage debt on the average high school or average household balance sheet. It's past credit cards, and somewhat amazingly, credit card debt is as a percentage of household income has actually declined over the past decade in terms of the debt service ratio, while it's been student loan debt that has really grown, if anything. But while there's a perception, as you said, that people are using credit for other reasons, that's why you have to look at the data, and the data just don't show people getting into hock because they're buying too many pizzas.
Well, you mentioned student loans and student debt. Maybe not in your book, or maybe in the book. Do you see how that's already starting to impact the economy? $1 trillion in student loan debt, that's huge.
It really is, and what we're seeing is, more than anything, is the combination of student loan debt and the like with the regulatory onslaught that we've seen since the financial crisis. I mean, the obvious place in which it is pinching has to do with mortgage markets, where the qualified mortgage rule, which basically has these cookie-cutter rules for who gets approved for a mortgage and who doesn't, including things like particular rules involving how much debt households can have. The interaction of student loan debt with these cookie-cutter sort of classic kind of brain-dead bureaucratic rulemaking is having an effect of freezing mortgage markets and the like. And so we do see a problem there, is that is interfering with people starting households buying homes, starting households, getting married, and everything else. That's a particular problem. And student loan debt does seem to be something that is unique in American history in terms of this massive layering on of student loan debt we've seen over the past few years.
Well, thanks. Because I was curious about that. Let's go back to what we were talking about a couple minutes ago in terms of there not really being a change in how folks utilize credit in their personal lives as much as there is kind of, if I could put words in your mouth, a change in kind of the delivery system of credit. So if all that's really changed is kind of the delivery system, what do you attribute all this attention to from Uncle Sam in terms of trying to raise the issue that folks are borrowing too much?
Well, this is, you know, is as I said before, one of the themes of American history is a recurrent hand-wringing by people that other people are using consumer credit irresponsibly. Everybody says, I can handle it, but nobody else can handle it properly. And so what we see is, you know, going back decades, well into the 18th century or 19th century, is concern that other people are using consumer credit improperly. And certainly it's been the case that as long as there has been consumer credit, there have been some people who have not been able to use it very well. You know, back in the so-called good old days, the criticism was that people were skipping meals so that they could pay their car payments, you know, in the 1940s and in times like that. So we see this sort of thing. But another thing we see, unfortunately, is government trying to control consumers by controlling the terms of consumer credit in a concern that consumers are overusing consumer credit. And in many ways, we can see a recurrent pattern in American history, really going back to the beginning of the 20th century when people first moved into the cities and they moved from the farms and immigrants came in and kind of had to deal with cyclical unemployment for the first time in factories. And the need for short-term credit that they didn't have in the same way when they lived on the farms and that sort of thing. And they ran right up against Victorian lending laws of strict usury ceilings and the like. And what we discovered was people needed credit, but suppliers couldn't provide credit at those costs. So what happened? Loan sharks proliferated. So that, you know, one estimate is in the 19-teens that 35% of New York City employees were in hock to loan sharks in New York City during that period. That there was reforms at the time that basically allowed small loan lending to be able to prevail and basically decided it was better to allow a little more expensive small loan laws than it was to have people getting their legs broken. That led all the way up to the Great Depression, and theory came out of the Great Depression that that too much access to consumer credit is what caused the Great Depression. That was actually a theory at the time. And the response was to crack down on small loan laws, to bring back interest rate ceilings and that sort of thing. And unfortunately, where that led to was that by the 1960s and 70s, the loan sharks were back. So for instance, in 1968, a United States Senate committee report said that loan sharking was the second largest revenue source of the mafia in 1968. I have a newspaper clipping that talks about when the legendary head of the Genovese crime family in New York City, Anthony Fat Tony Soprano, Salerno, Anthony Fat Tony Salerno, was indicted on 11 counts of loan sharking and, yes, one count of criminal solicitation for having somebody's legs broken. He was running $80 million a day in his territory in New York City, which is about $463 million in current dollars. And that led people to basically say, you know, it'd be better to have, payday lenders than it would be to have leg breakers. Unfortunately, what it looks like is we're going through the same cycle right now, which is after the 2008 crisis, which people have widely misunderstood, a theory came about that it was too much access to credit, and certainly mortgages were a problem, the kind of mortgages that were made and the amount of housing debt. But it spilled over into all these other sorts of things. And in the hands of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and the architects of Dodd-Frank and the Credit Card Act of 2009 and everything else, what we've seen is we've systematically started taking away choices from consumers, and in particular low-income consumers. And so while a large number of consumers lost access to credit cards after the Credit Card Act of 2009, payday lenders, pawn shops have boomed. And of course, what is Washington's approach to that? Washington instead basically says, now it's time to start going after the payday lenders and everybody else. And we've kind of seen from history how this story proceeds, how it ends. And historically, it hasn't ended very well. And I've not seen any reason to believe that that this story is moving in any the current story is moving in any more productive direction.
The history repeats itself, doesn't it?
History does repeat itself if you don't pay attention to the unintended consequences of what you're doing.
You mentioned something at the tail end there, Todd, in terms of folks on the lower end of the economic ladder having access to credit cards cut off, and now our friends in government want to go after, and I'm not here to advocate for payday, but want to go after their payday and pawnbrokers. It seems to me that what we're talking about is the regulators kind of chasing after and hurting the very people that they're intending to help, and driving them right back into, as you said, the Fat Tonys of the world.
Yeah, and that's what's tragic about all this, Bill, is that I think I think it is well intentioned that they look out at the world and sort of economically unsophisticated people think that they're going to help people, but they end up hurting exactly the people they want to help. You know, it's sort of like squeezing a balloon. First, you can adjust the terms of loans so that if, for instance, regulate interest rates, credit card companies will just attach annual fees to cards. Back in the days when interest rates were regulated on credit cards, this is one of the reasons why department stores dominated and were able to offer credit, was they could just bury the losses on their credit operations and the below market interest rate ceilings by raising the price of the goods. So one famous study compared the price of a refrigerator in Texas to a refrigerator in Arkansas, and Arkansas had very strict usury ceilings. And a refrigerator in Arkansas costs 8% more than it did in Texas, basically, to make up for the fact that Arkansas department stores couldn't charge a market rate of interest. And the bottom line here is you can't wish away the need of consumers for credit. And whether it is the short-term need to smooth income expenses or the great opportunity that I described of the wealth-building opportunities of getting consumer durables and getting things that make people's lives better and more convenient and less expensive over the long run, there seems to be this wish among regulators that they can either magically make the need for credit disappear or magically conjure into being, against all laws of economics, good credit at a low price, even for people who don't have very good credit. And that wishful thinking just doesn't turn out to be a very viable regulatory strategy.
Yeah. We are talking about your book today, and I take it I could probably say that this is part of the book tour, and so I'm wondering if on your previous stops on the book tour with respect to the law of unintended consequences and hurting folks need access to credit most. If the issue has come up at all in terms of being a civil rights issue, nobody in their right mind on Capitol Hill or at any of the federal regulators would be going after anybody's Amex Black card if they have one. But they seem to feel very comfortable going after folks that need access to small dollar credit from a finance company or a pawnbroker.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, it's kind of a funny and sort of tragic sort of thing. I won't try to guess what they're thinking or why they're thinking what they're thinking. But what we can see, for instance, take payday lending. I don't think anybody's really a fan of payday lending. I know I'm not. But when I look out at the world, what I see, who are the people who use payday loans? Those are people who either don't have credit cards or would max out their credit cards and have to pay all kind of fees and stuff if they didn't use credit cards. They are people who basically are choosing between payday loans and bank overdraft protection and maybe pawn shops. And when you put yourself in their shoes, and when you actually look at the way these people use credit, most of them are making decisions that an economist would consider to be rational, given their constraints, given what their options actually are. And when you take away payday lending, for instance, what you do is you just see people use bank overdraft protection more often, which is certainly no less expensive than payday loans. And so you can shift people from one product to another, but forcing people to use less preferred rather than more preferred options doesn't seem to be a way to make their lives better off. It's possible, it's conceivable that you might, but before you start taking choices away from people who already have limited choices, I think you really want to make sure that you understand what they're actually trying to do and whether or not they're trying to do it. And so I think bottom line is, I'm not sure what's in their heads, but what we know is that over time, there's been well-intentioned paternalistic regulation premised on the idea that bureaucrats know best, that regulators know better than, Sally Jones sitting at her kitchen table trying to figure out how she's going to pay the rent, the gas bill, and for Johnny's braces with the amount of money she has in the bank and everything else that she has. And, what comes out is that by and large, people do pretty well, that over time people figure out how to manage their credit, how to manage their finances, and maybe they make some mistakes, but there's certainly no evidence that central planners in Washington do better than people based on their own local circumstances and experiences do with respect to figuring out how to make ends meet.
What a novel idea, Todd, actually having faith in people.
That's right.
It's good to hear. We've talked about the history of credit, some of the changes from working with the storefront retailer to credit cards. What do you see in terms of, on the horizon in terms of credit innovations?
Well, it's an interesting it's a fascinating question, Bill, and thanks for asking that and thinking about that, because we kind of stand in my view on an equipoise, which is we stand on the precipice of a potential for an unleashing of innovation and consumer choice like we've possibly never seen in history, at least since the innovation of the credit card, which is just an extraordinary thing. And just to pause for a moment, and it's worth just marveling at a credit card, right? An instantaneous 24-hour payment mechanism that can be accepted anywhere in the world is a secure method that can be used for payments for credit. Online, in person, on the phone. I mean, it's really just an amazing sort of thing. I think we may be on the precipice of similar sorts of things, with possible innovations in mobile banking, possible innovations of the use of the internet to promote competition and consumer choice, and to allow consumers more choice, more options, and greater competition than we've ever seen before. My concern is that just as we have the potential for this, we're running up against this economic or this regulatory monster that Dodd-Frank is layering on top of all the regulations that were in place previously. I mean, just start with the Durbin Amendment, which is, created price controls on interchange fees on debit cards and is right now proving to be the single biggest obstacle to innovation with respect to mobile banking and the opportunity to create mobile banking for low-income consumers. Because basically, if you make mobile banking too good, then you run up against the Durbin Amendment's price controls, which is just insane. I think, as I said, regulations like the Credit Card Act, which have reduced access to credit cards, especially for low-income consumers. We've seen double-digit drops in the number of low-income consumers with credit cards dropped by like 11 percentage points in the period since the financial crisis and the Credit Card Act. And so, it kind of worries me, which is that we've got this great opportunity before us to unleash new opportunities for consumers using electronic mechanisms in a cashless society, while at the same time we have people who are longing for a 1930s-style financial system and a paternalistic regulation that are depriving consumers of all these products that can make their lives better.
Well, you know, Todd, I'd like to focus in on the last half of your comment in terms of a revolution in innovation that could unleash the economy. But I must admit that I'm a little focused in on the way you began your answer there in terms of, with credit cards, anywhere, anytime in the world, somebody can get access to credit. Which sends a shiver down my spine because I just sent my daughter overseas for a semester abroad.
Good luck with that, Phil.
But that's my personal problem. Let me ask you this. We'll make this the last question and turn it back over to Dean to see if we've got any questions from those who have called in this afternoon. But is there any basic takeaway that you would like to leave folks with in terms of what consumer credit and the American economy, your book, is trying to convey?
Thanks, Bill. And first I'll say, with respect to your daughter and also as a father to daughter, is paternalism in its proper origin, basically, I'm in favor of fathers controlling how their daughters spend their money overseas.
I knew I liked you.
I think that, those are, if there's one takeaway, it is that, which is that the consumers use credit in an economically rational way, that we can model consumer behavior and have done it, over a century. Economists have developed a model of how consumers use consumer credit, and it makes sense. And if we want to have regulations, we should start with the way we think about how consumers want to use credit and help them to accomplish it to make their lives better. Instead, what we see today are models of behavioral economics, for instance, all these sorts of things that start with the presumption that consumers don't really know what they're doing. The consumers have to be protected from themselves. They have to be protected from lenders and that sort of thing. And that leads you down a completely different road, and a road that turns out being designed to hurt exactly the people it supposedly intends. And so what we are hoping is that this book will provide a research agenda for economists to think about how consumers use credit, and a mechanism for regulators and policymakers and people involved in that sphere to start with sounder assumptions about how consumers use credit, and hopefully make more sophisticated policy that avoids all these unintended consequences that we've seen that recur in history.
Are you going to put any of your law students through the paces to read this this book?
That's the goal. Eventually, it is designed to be a course book as well as a book for the general public. And one of the things you'll see is, even though, as you said at the outset, Bill, it's a large book, but I think it's well written. People, sort of ordinary people who've looked at it, have said it's very readable. And what you'll see is, even though there are several chapters that are fairly specialized, and those will be the ones for the law students, the economics students, the key ideas in the book about how consumers use credit, the myth of exploding consumer debt, the unintended consequences of regulation, that sort of thing, is very accessible to most people. And we found that people who have picked it up and started reading it have found themselves to be surprised by what they're learning, and find it to be very well written and enlightening.
Yeah, it is a very useful resource, and as at least one of the so-called experts on this call, I've found it very very helpful so far. Dean, do we have any questions from the audience?
Well, let's check in. We have to open the floor mode in order to find out. So in a moment, okay, We'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to our first caller, let me make a brief commercial announcement that we'll have a Teleform conference call tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll be discussing the indictment of Texas Governor Rick Perry with Professor John Baker. That's tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And I just want to reiterate for folks that the book that we're discussing today, in the notice you got of today's call, there's a handy link to the book on the Amazon page. It's, I guess, available on Amazon and probably bookstores everywhere. Right now, Bill, we've got two callers with questions, so let's go to that first caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. I'd like to find out if three points are addressed in your book. The first is securitization of consumer loans and how that might contribute to a crash of the economy. The second is whether there are ways that public education could be enhanced to teach people to make, while they're still young, to make more rational consumer credit choices. And third is the issue of the use of the Social Security number as a universal identifier for not only for credit, but even for non-credit purposes like opening a bank account or getting a job, and the vulnerability of that to the disclosure of that for identity theft.
Thanks, John, and it's always a pleasure to hear your voice. So thanks for calling in. We don't discuss any of those issues very much. And again, for those on the call, a reminder: yes, about securitization, education and financial literacy, and the use of Social Security numbers. With respect to securitization, I think we talk a little bit about it in the book, but not a lot. In securitization of credit card receivables, for instance, have been around for a long time, and have not really ever seemed to be a source of much instability. Obviously, that's different from securitization of mortgage debt, which many people think raised a lot of problems the last time around. And unfortunately, in the book, which is already quite a large book, we don't talk that much about mortgage debt, just basically because when we were writing the book, we decided that was a topic unto itself. So maybe that's consumer mortgage credit in the American economy, volume two or something like that. So we don't talk about that very much. We do. Go ahead. Yeah, John.
If I can add in just a point on securitization, John, I think you mentioned the negative impact it could have on the economy. I think it's important to keep in mind that when you're talking about the securitizations we saw in the mortgage arena, those were all based on the presumption that what folks were signing up for investing in those securities were appreciating assets. Whether you're talking about credit card receivables or automobiles, the securitizations in consumer credit, nobody is operating under the assumption that what they're buying is an appreciating asset. And I think also, like Todd said, in the credit card space, the evidence from the auto space as well is that these securities have performed fairly well through and after the economic crisis.
Right. But it is an interesting point, Bill, and you and I have discussed this, which is like the media, who seems to find, who's looking for the next financial crisis under every bed, and without any evidence, has been hand-wringing about auto loans and the like, which sort of shows the importance of sort of really understanding the economics of these products. on financial literacy and financial education, we discussed that a little bit in terms of that, and that's an area in which there hasn't been a lot of research done, and you know there's still a lot of experimentation going on to try to figure out how to best do that for consumers, and that's an area I'm hoping that people will do more research in the future. And with respect to the identity theft and the Social Security numbers and that sort of thing, I agree with you, John, that that's an issue that's a very important issue. I think a lot of issues around the question of data security, you know, things like the target breach, how we get our incentives aligned properly with respect to who bears the risk, but to, among different parties for identity theft issues. And again, here's one of those places in which I hate to sound like a broken record, but again, this is another area in which counterproductive regulation like the Durbin Amendment, I think, is going to actually harm consumer data security by interfering with the process of free contracting between credit card networks and issuers and merchants to try to figure out how to best allocate the risk of things like that by basically putting price controls on debit card interchange fees that determine how much you can recoup for your investments in security and fraud prevention and that sort of thing. And I think that's one of those examples of economically mistaken regulatory interventions.
If I can add another point on public education, John, half advertisement, half data point, if you will. Our association has got an online free curriculum of 36 units called Money Skill, and that's moneyskill.org, that's designed for high school and college students. It goes through income and expenses, budgeting, insurance, renting versus owning your own home, those sorts of things. And so I offer that out for everyone that's on the call. In terms of the research with respect to what Todd said, we're even still having trouble developing the metrics to see how well students retain the information they get from these, because it's really tough to kind of follow the students through their lifespan in terms of getting permission from parents or from themselves, that matter, to kind of track them. So the data to do the research on is really tough to get.
We've got just the one question pending. If you want to join the queue for questions today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Alden Abbott, Heritage Foundation. Todd, do you have any comments on recent Operation Choke Point developments, reports that the FDIC may have withdrawn a list of quote-unquote suspect industries, including the purveyors of financial services to small consumers, and in particular, what the promulgation of lists with no known correlations or ties to particular risk patterns as industrial areas that should be shunned by financial institutions says about current policy?
Well, you may know as much about this as me, Alden, but I've heard that. I've heard that you know, I think that this is an area in which congressional oversight seems to have brought to light some of the dark corners of what was going on here. At the same time, I keep hearing stories about other you know, legitimate businesses and other industries that are losing bank accounts and that sort of thing, seemingly linked to Operation Choke Point. But you really put your finger on the main thing, which is how poorly conceived the whole operation is. Assuming it's not just a backdoor way of getting rid of industries that the current administration doesn't like, which it may be, but otherwise things like you know, using as a proxy just the number of return payments for, as the payday lenders showed in their suit, you know, a payment for a payday loan could be returned either because it was fraudulent or simply because the borrower didn't have enough money to pay it. And there's no way, you know, just on a rough cut to be able to distinguish among those. And so, you know, what hopefully what they're recognizing is that that it's not an appropriate regulatory mechanism to try to starve legal companies to death simply by choking off their ability to get payments. And hopefully they're secondly recognizing that if they want to try to delve into some of these things, they have to be more sophisticated about it, and they have to actually do something rigorous in what they were doing. And one might even go so far as to say that maybe they should do it publicly and transparently through a proper process rather than just doing it behind closed doors with nudges and winks. But if you have anything to add to that, Alden, I know you've been following this issue for the Heritage Foundation.
No, I no, nothing right now. I think the FDIC's apparent withdrawal of a list was useful, but it's not clear what the rest of the financial regulatory institutions are doing, and it's certainly something that merits continued surveillance, one might say, by a watchful public.
Alden, this is Bill. I can't thank you enough for making that last comment that you did in terms of the vigilance from all of us, because my fear is, despite the withdrawal of the FDIC's list and perhaps a backing off of something called choke point, it really demonstrates a propensity or a willingness by at least some in the regulatory community to use the examination and supervision powers that they have to really promote, you know, their own moral agenda as to what they think are appropriate businesses or not. So even though, you know, we may have won this particular skirmish or made some progress on it, I do think that the problem's not going away.
We do have another question pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another question.
Yes, this is Stephen Casey, Austin, Texas. One of the issues that I've come across, because I've done a lot of mortgage foreclosure defense, is the court system, and particularly in circuits that are staffed, you would think just by their resumes, by a lot of Fed SOC type supportive judges, I think seeing them treating consumers versus mortgage banks with an uneven hand, because, you know, the principles of Fed SOC, I think one is that let the buyer beware. That's the rule of the marketplace, and so you hold people accountable to their contracts, but at the same time, the rule of law must prevail. And when you get into these courts where you see banks doing an inordinate amount of fraud, that consumers are getting dismissed in the federal system at a 12B6 stage, and those exact same claims when they're brought in, for example, like in a bankruptcy court where the burden is on the creditor, or they're brought in a state that's a judicial foreclosure state where the burden is on the bank to show chain of ownership on a lot of these things, they are winning cases in California, the winning cases in Florida, winning cases in New York, and some of the older states that are judicial foreclosure, but losing them in the non-judicial foreclosure state. I wonder if you could comment on that, because it would seem that as long as you have the rule of law, that's going to protect from the broken legs because you've got the criminal system and from the loan sharks. And as long as you have the rule of the marketplace, let the buyer beware, then people are going to uphold the rule of contracts, whether it's a bad or good contract, and they're going to learn the consequences of their actions.
I don't have any particular comments on that. I haven't looked at the cases as closely as you have, and that's not something we really cover in the book, except to the extent that I would agree with the basic the structure of how you address it. So, you know, in terms of thinking about the trade-off between enforceability of contracts, debtor defenses, versus creditor rights and that sort of thing. And from a policy perspective, all I could say is that we know that there's a trade-off here, which is that making, increasing protections for debtors that make foreclosure more expensive, more difficult, that sort of thing, raises the price of credit, reduces access to credit, and that sort of thing. And then at that point, that's basically the economics of it. And how one trades that off is a policy question as to how much of a price, whether it's on debt collection or foreclosure or whatever the case may be. We talk about this in the book, that making debt collection less effective or more expensive reduces access to credit and raises the cost of credit. With respect to the specific details of what you're describing, Stephen, that's an interesting point. And I just don't know enough of the details about those particular cases to say how those should play out in those particular instances.
Okay.
Our phone lines are open. If you have a question, you need to push the star button and the pound button on your telephone while we wait. Bill, I don't know if you have another question for Todd.
I have one quick question. Todd, how do I get you to autograph my copy?
I guess you could send it to me, and I'll be happy to autograph it and send it back. So.
All right.
Good. Well, let me make a final call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Looks like we do have one more question. So let's check in with what might be our final question here.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. On another point that doesn't come up very often but perhaps needs to be addressed, that is the abuse of credit by lenders for purposes other than collecting what is owed them. This is sometimes addressed under abuse of process or malicious prosecution, but I've seen a number of cases where lenders conspire with parties who want to use credit to destroy their political opponents or other people that they are trying to disadvantage in the marketplace or in the arena generally, and how much attention do you see that might be given to abusive lending practices intended for purposes other than just to collect what's owed?
I'm not familiar with. I have no reason to doubt what you say. I'm just not familiar with those cases and the examples that you're talking about and how those exactly play out. And so I don't really have any comment on it. We generally talk about the economics of debt collection in the book and in the like, but it sounds like maybe you're getting at something different, and it's not something that that's something I'm particularly familiar with. So, but it's something I'll look to be more aware of. So, if you have any sources you think it would be interesting for me to read on that, please just email them to me, and I'll be interested in following up. Thanks.
Yeah, John, the only thing I could add is that Todd and I were speaking earlier about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. I can tell you that they've got a complaint database, and for the first couple of years of their existence, mortgage-related complaints kind of led the number of complaints that they had by factors of 10. The number of complaints that they're getting related to debt collection has now surpassed on a monthly basis the mortgage complaints, and I think you can expect to see a lot of attention by the CFPB with respect to debt collection complaints. That having been said, the lending community, as you know, has rather extensive guidelines that they have to abide by under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. So I'm not familiar with the specific cases you cite, but there's likely to be a lot of attention on that the rest of this year and going into 2015.
Professor Zawicki, any final thoughts before we adjourn the call?
No, I just want to thank the Federal Society for hosting this, and hopefully people find the book interesting and learn something from it. I know when I first started working on these issues, I had kind of started off by thinking about these issues many years ago through the lens of the conventional wisdom, and kind of my impressions were that people were overusing, misusing credit and that sort of thing. And in the process of reading this history, examining the data, I came to see a very different view of the world and a very beneficent role for credit and for consumer choice, and in many ways a great respect for how consumers use credit. And I think that's reflected in the book. And you know, everything I've said is my opinion. I'm not speaking for my co-authors, but I've been blessed to have several very gifted co-authors, economists from whom I've learned a lot, and hopefully those who read the book will learn a lot as well. And so I want to thank you, Dean. I want to thank Bill Himpler for hosting the call today.
Well, this is Dean Reuter. Once again, the name of the book, the title of the book, Consumer Credit and the American Economy, a link to that book was in the notice you got for today's call if you want to try and pick up a copy on Amazon.com. My thanks go out to Bill Himpler and to Professor Zawicki. Certainly appreciate you joining our call today. And a reminder to the audience that tomorrow, our next Teleforum conference call scheduled at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be talking about the indictment of Texas Governor Rick Perry with Professor John Baker. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.